Strange Times in New Boston, episode number 9, What Next? Welcome to Strange Times in New Boston, and welcome to this, the 9th episode of this podcast. I am Glenn Dickey and will be your guide as we explore these strange times. In this episode, I'm going to discuss listener mail, cancel culture, explore the question of what is economic growth. If you have any questions or comments about the podcast, please send them to me at Strange Times in New Boston, all one word, at hushmail.com. Mail. In this month, I'm adding a new segment, Mail. Last month's show generated some mail, and while most of it stands on its own as a fine example of some listeners' opinions, I think a few have the wit to deserve a response. One listener writes, "You are just trying to cop out of your share of racial guilt. You are white." Another listener opines, "It's not about racial biology, it's about racial culture." I think I have refuted these two points in my earlier podcast and so won't address them further here. Yet another listener says that I am ignoring structural racism and cites critical race theory in support for that position. I want to be clear. Some structural racism, without a doubt, exists in some places in our country, but I do not think that it is nearly as widespread as some would have us believe. If you want to assert that because in the past there was a dominant culture that was composed of Christian European descendants, I can hardly deny that. What I can deny is that those people's descendants are, one, incapable of change, and two, that we are in the same place we were in 1861. It's true that critical race theory believes this, but critical race theory is nothing more than a theoretical framework that is yet to receive scientific validation, and in my opinion, never will. Critical race theory lacks a mean to falsify it, which basically dooms it as capital S science. Critical race theory holds that white supremacy is maintained over time, and therefore anyone who argues against critical race theory is de facto proof of it. This kind of circular reasoning isn't a hallmark of science. Not to mention, critical race theory is completely unable to describe why history has evolved as it has over the last 170-odd years. Finally, did you happen to see Reason Magazine's October issue? It cites virtually every police reform demanded by groups like Black Lives Matter while rejecting the wholesale defunding of police. Let's go down the list. Restricting asset forfeiture, ending over-policing, releasing police body camera footage, ending the war for drugs, rethinking crisis response, regulating police use of force, and reconsidering the value of police unions. Did I miss anything? Now, if critical race theory is correct, why would a movement composed largely, but not exclusively, of white men have such values, and why would they have maintained such values for decades in the face of opposition from both the left and the right? In 1721, the author Jonathan Swift wrote, "Reasoning will never make a man correct an ill opinion, which by reasoning he never acquired," which has come down to us in a modern form as, "You cannot reason people out of something they were not reasoned into." Critical race theory isn't reasonable, and I doubt if I or anyone is going to be able to change any of its adherents' minds through reasoned argument and evidence. If you want to claim that former President Barack Obama, business magnate Oprah Winfrey, or any number of very rich sports figures are somehow oppressed, and that they have more in common with inner-city poor minorities than those same inner-city poor minorities have with other inner-city poor minorities that look different, good luck. Personally, I thought the Marxists made a lot more sense when they were arguing that it was all about class. Cancel culture is left McCarthyism. I was listening to a liberal gentleman on a different podcast when he said something that I found profound and thought I would share it. The gentleman, Eric Weinstein, referred to cancel culture as left McCarthyism. For anyone who may not remember their 20th century history, Wikipedia describes McCarthyism as the practice of making accusations of subversion or treason without proper regard for evidence. It makes sense when you think about it, but I had not thought about it in those terms before. In the late 1940s and 50s, hundreds of Americans were accused of being communists or of being communist sympathizers, often unfairly, and using suspect and or questionable evidence. Victims of McCarthyism were blacklisted, which resulted in diminished work opportunities or the destruction of their careers, notably Lucille Ball, Leonard Bernstein, Charlie Chaplin, W.E.B. Du Bois, Albert Einstein, author Arthur Miller, Allen Ginsberg, J. Robert Oppenheimer, father of the atomic bomb, Dorothy Parker, Linus Pauling, Edward G. Robinson, Dalton Trimbo, and Orson Welles, just to mention a few. We will probably never know how many lesser personages, careers, or families were wrecked by McCarthyism during that period. Like the witch trials of 400 years earlier, with McCarthyism, just the accusation on the flimsiest of pretexts is enough to get you burned at the stake, or in the 1950s to ruin your career and possibly your life. The problem with McCarthyism wasn't that there were not real communists and communist spies in the U.S. and in the U.S. government during this period, but that the standard of evidence used to indict these people was so low. Ultimately, the proponents of McCarthyism would overplay their hand in accusing the United States Army of harboring communists and would be dealt a major defeat in the televised Army-McCarthy hearings of 1954. McCarthyism would go on to gradually fade, but later it would be shown that real tyrants, like J. Edgar Hoover, used the pretext of detecting communists to subvert the law and crush political enemies, and groups not meeting the approval of the corrupt and powerful FBI director. Fast forward to today, and the charge of being a racist or Nazi or white supremacist is thrown around by the left at anyone who disagrees with them and their political agenda. If you refuse to accept the left's political line and have the temerity to say so publicly, you should expect very real consequences in terms of employment offers and advancement in your chosen career, depending on what your career is. Even if you are factually correct in what you say, even if you have been a lifelong leftist, or have your remarks taken out of context, you may not escape the mob mentality that pervades much of our culture. Here is a list of some notable personages from our era and their crimes. J.K. Rowling, author of the much-beloved Harry Potter series, accused of being transphobic for suggesting that identifying as a woman does not make you one. Harold Ulig, University of Chicago professor, who suggested that BLM was taking the wrong approach by calling for defunding the police. Professor Ulig would later be reinstated. Juan Williams was canned from his role as host of Talk of the Nation on NPR for suggesting that he felt nervous when he saw people in Muslim garb on a plane immediately after 9/11. Juan Williams now works for Fox News as a co-host of The Five. Guess those conservatives aren't so racist, eh, Juan? Moving on, James Bennett of the New York Times lost his job for publishing an opinion written by Senator Tom Cotton supporting the Insurrection Act on the opinion page. I don't see how putting down revolts and riots with federal troops is even controversial, but then I don't work at the New York Times. Neil Golightly, a senior executive at Boeing, was forced to resign after the former U.S. military pilot wrote an article arguing that women should not serve in combat. The catch is, he wrote the article in 1987, 33 years previous. Katie Herzog, a lesbian and freelance journalist, wrote an article in The Stranger about trans people who halt or reverse sex transitions. She was labeled a transphobe and would ultimately end up living in the deeply wooded Olympic Peninsula to a move she made to avoid being treated like a pariah in her hometown of Seattle. Nicholas Sandman, a teenager attending a Right to Life rally in Washington, D.C., who simply stood and smiled sphinx-like when confronted by Nathan Phillips and a Native American activist played a drum in his face. And this incident produced howls of outrage and anger from the media, who conveniently misrepresented or omitted crucial details in their coverage. Nicholas Sandman would go on to receive settlements of an undisclosed amount from CNN and the Washington Post, with other suits still pending. But make no mistake, his life will never be the same. And who else? Maybe you? Maybe me. Don't get out of line. Don't speak out against those that you think oppress you. Free speech is violence. And if you do, you might find a mob outside your house, or find yourself being escorted from the business you used to work at. Or maybe one day the phone will just stop ringing with job offers, and then you will know you've been canceled. We're probably never going to know how many lives have been distorted and ruined by our modern left McCarthyism. But just as people who were victims of the original form wear it today as a badge of honor, we may hope that someday in the future, the people who are victims of the modern form of left McCarthyism will do so with equal pride. The move no one makes. During the discussion, Mr. Weinstein made another comment that I thought was particularly apt. He isn't the first person I've heard discuss the problems of how to break through the political stalemate that is gripping our nation, and particularly Congress, but his comment had more eloquence than others I've heard, so I thought I would share it. This is an excerpt, and this is Mr. Weinstein speaking.
There's a huge problem that we need to get to, which is that the reason that we can't get out of our national nightmare at the moment is that the center has to make a move that it refuses to do. And the center, or the core, maybe it would be a better way of saying it, has to admit that it became kleptocratic. And so the corruption of the core left and the core right means that there's nowhere to turn from the extremes.
The particular phrase that got my attention was the line, the center has to make a move that it refuses to do, and there's nowhere to turn from the extremes. I think this line sums up a lot of what other folks have been talking about. The center in national American politics has decayed so much that even the more moderate members of Congress do not look across the aisle to their brothers and sisters of the opposition and try to make a compromise, but instead look to the extremes of either party and move further away from the center. To use a visual metaphor, it used to be a continuous spectrum from one end of the left to the right, but these days the spectrum is not continuous. There's a hole in the middle, and there is no one trying to bridge the divided ends moving further and further apart, like two trains going in opposite directions. No doubt we can blame some of this on the skyrocketing ratio of citizens to one House seat. Not that anyone is interested in that explanation. To be in Congress was never meant to be a position for elites, but today it certainly is. We can also blame some of this on the changes to Congress wrought in the 1990s by Speaker Newt Gingrich, although I personally think those changes would have been made even if Speaker Gingrich had never been elected, because they were an idea that's time had come. Both parties now take their cues from the extreme ends of their parties, and calls for compromise and consideration are shouted down by both sides. These days, it's just as Texas liberal Jim Hightower put it so many years ago, there's nothing in the middle of the road but yellow stripes and dead armadillos. At this point, the only thing that is certain, as Congress proves its dysfunctionality yet again with the stalling of the second coronavirus relief package, is that they will cede more of their power to the federal bureaucracy and to the imperial presidency. The federal government is a nothing more than a mace that the party in control uses to beat the opposition with until it is their turn. What is growth? Another question that has been on my mind a lot recently is the question of what economic growth is. Let me preface my comments by saying that this is an issue that I think a lot of people both on the left and the right get wrong, including, and maybe especially, people with a libertarian bent. Here's the scenario. Supercorp is a large multinational corporation and comes in and buys up Small Business Inc., a much smaller and predominantly national business. Now, Supercorp has noticed that the product that Small Business Inc. makes could be manufactured in some distant land for less money and result in a tidy profit for Supercorp. Supercorp buys Small Business Inc., fires everyone, ships the manufacturing plant and jobs overseas, begins manufacturing the product in a distant land, and then, with a complete lack of irony, begins to sell the product back to the national market, thereby making a tidy profit in the bargain. Now tell me, is that economic growth? A lot of people will tell you that yes, this is the creative destruction of market forces, and now all those people who got canned from Small Business Inc. are free to go and do something more productive with their time. Maybe they should apply for a job at Supercorp. For a long time, that would have been my answer as well. Personally, I wasn't that concerned with the dismal science of economics, and economic questions were way down the list for why I believed what I believe. I just went with the canned answer that my team deployed. That answer seemed to be fairly satisfying until you consider how the world actually functions, not in a simplistic scenario, but in the real world that we all inhabit. The original question, is this economic growth, can be answered a number of ways depending on whose perspective we are using. From the perspective of Supercorp, there is no question this is economic growth. They will make a profit from their creative destruction and enrich themselves and their shareholders. Champagne corks are popping, and let's go find another Small Corp Inc. and do this all over again. From the perspective of the investors and probably the management of Small Corp Inc., the question is more up for grabs. Did the investors get a fair price for their investment? If they got a good price, then maybe it is champagne corks for them as well. If they did not get a good price, well, maybe they lost money on the whole deal. Supercorp is smart, and they probably took advantage of short-term market forces to buy Small Corp Inc. at a moment of weakness, and why wouldn't they? Maybe the investors in Small Corp Inc. learned a valuable lesson about investing, and next time won't be so stupid with their money. From the perspective of the people that actually worked for Small Corp Inc., the question is also pretty nebulous. Once upon a time, the people that worked for Small Corp Inc. and were not management were called workers. Keeping workers happy was a major concern of one party in our two-party system, but those days have long since passed. If the worker was relatively young or had some skill that was in high demand, maybe they could successfully transition to some other employer. On the other hand, if the worker was older or did not have a skill in high demand, this probably represents a financial catastrophe for them. If Small Corp Inc. was in a major metro area, then maybe there is somewhere else for the older, less demanded worker to transition to. But if Small Corp Inc. was based outside a major metro area, then what? Now you are faced with a home you can't sell, a job market that is empty, and a lack of community service because everyone else is in the same situation you are. Sure, you can hang on and maybe something will come along, or maybe you will win the lottery. It could happen. Were our society solely composed of 20-something workers who didn't have long-term mortgages or families or ties to a particular region or place, then the conventional argument of creative destruction would make a lot more sense. Even if the creative destruction was occurring solely within one national scope, it would be a lot more tolerable. A worker could move from one part of the country to another, but when the change is going outside of the national economy? Well, there are probably exceptional individuals who could move to the far distant land and make it work, but for most people, that is just not going to be a realistic option. From the perspective of the elites of the far distant land where Supercorp moved the jobs, it is probably time to pop champagne corks as well. Their economy just got bigger, and their economic power just increased. They don't happen to be capitalist, but they don't mind if the leaders of Supercorp want to tell themselves that their actions are virtuous because of some weird idea like creative destruction. The elites of the distant land have no interest in pursuing reciprocal free trade policies, even if they sign treaties to that effect, and are going to violate them and are threatened Supercorp if they complain. Does this scenario sound familiar? From the perspective of the workers in the far distant land, you would think it would be time for champagne corks as well, or maybe beer cans or whatever they celebrate with. But unfortunately, they are slaves. Let's rather call them involuntarily indentured servants paying off their debt to society. And the elites of that distant land don't give a damn what they think. Those quote-unquote workers should shut up and do their job if they don't want to go back to a re-education camp, or worse. If they live in a toxic sewer because far distant land lacks adequate environmental safeguards, well, far distant land has a surplus of population, so no great loss if some get sick and die. I will ask the question again, is this economic growth? Somebody made money off this deal, doesn't that automatically make it growth? As I alluded to earlier, keeping workers happy and content used to be one of the major concerns for one of our big political parties. But unfortunately, those days have long since passed. Raising issues like this is not the normal home turf that I, as a guy with an R after my name, can say I'm all that comfortable with. Shouldn't this be an issue that the other team moves forward? If you think that, let me disabuse you of such antiquated notions. There is no distance between the country club right or left on this issue. Given traditional party roles, we might expect the right to be less concerned with the rights of small businesses and workers, as historically this has been the left's natural province. However, in the topsy-turvy world of modern politics, the left's unbridled support for open borders, an ever-increasing regulatory state, and undying love and affinity for communist China are making this issue worse than ever. It must be with an increasing sense of grim irony that the left can claim to be the defender of the little guy and the small business. Which little guy? Which small business? The one in distant land with whom our nation lacks a reciprocal free trade policy? I guess if no one else is going to stick up for workers, it is going to be left, no pun intended, to Republicans like me to point out that the policies of the left are as hostile to the American worker as those of the open borders Koch brothers. Let me go on the record and say that in my opinion, this scenario is not one of economic growth. It is economic cannibalism, where a sector of our economy eats another sector. This is a business devouring their fellow citizens. This isn't growth, at least as far as the American workers are concerned. And if the government isn't there to protect American workers, then you have to ask yourself, who are our public servants there to protect? The leaders of the left will say that what you need to do is to give up on those manufacturing jobs that aren't coming back and learn how to code. Well, I have news for you. The open borders H-1B policies pursued by elements of both the left and the right are going to make you compete with people who will work for a fraction of what you need to pay off your student loans and still maintain an American standard of living. You are going to need to compete with people who have had their entire education paid for by a foreign government. I don't blame immigrants for wanting to come to the United States. If I was in their shoes, I would do exactly the same. But let's not kid ourselves. Supercorp doesn't want to train American knowledge workers up to a higher standard. It is far better for Supercorp to import already trained folks via the H-1B process and then throw those people away when they no longer fit their needs. Good luck, American workers, because you are probably going to need it. 2020 New Hampshire House Session. Once again, I have completed an analysis of our representative's performance in the New Hampshire House during the abbreviated 2020 session, and the results are not at all what I expected. I am a believer in the old saying that past performance is the best predictor of future performance, but the analysis this time around had some very real surprises, at least to me. I have added a spreadsheet to the show notes which lists every recorded vote by our representatives, how the Democratic Party leadership voted, and whether the vote was considered to be against or for individual liberty. I have calculated the number of votes missed by our representatives, as I did with my analysis during the last House session, and I am going to start with that question. Are they going to work? It seems reasonable that if you run for a public office, you intend to go to the public office and do the work that you said you were going to do. And here is where the surprises start. Out of the 195 votes recorded, Representative Woodbury missed only one vote in the entire 2020 session. Right on, Representative Woodbury. I may not agree with him on many issues, but I respect the fact that he did the job he ran for, especially considering that he is an older American in the midst of a pandemic. Way to go, Representative Woodbury. You get an A+ for attendance. And unfortunately, that is the end of the good news as far as our representatives showing up for work goes. Representative Kat McGee, our District 40 Flotario representative, out of 195 recorded votes, missed a mind-numbing 84 votes. That gives her an absence rate of 43.1%. The public trusted Representative McGee to do the job, and she did half of it. In the private world, they would can your ass in a heartbeat if you tried to pull this crap. 43.1%? That's missing 2 days and five and being late on another day. Representative McGee clearly had better things to do with her time than conduct the people's business. If you are going to miss voting on this kind of a scale, you should resign and let someone else do the job that you can't or won't. Representative McGee had an attendance rate of 56.9%, which earns her the grade of F for not effing showing up. I understand that Representative McGee will not be running again in District 40, but is instead seeking to represent the citizens of Hollis in the next election. I hope the citizens of Hollis will take time to reflect on Representative McGee's attendance and carefully consider whether she is worthy of future public trust. And now we come to Representative Mombourquette. Sometimes when I'm building the spreadsheet, I run across a calculation that looks so wrong that I have to go back and check the source data because you don't want to publish something that unfairly denigrates someone, or at least I don't. So according to the New Hampshire House of Representatives voting records for Representative Mombourquette, she managed to miss 98 of 195 votes, which gives her an absence rate of 50.3%. She missed more votes than she made, and she attended no recorded votes in the month of March at all. I don't know what Representative Mombourquette was doing, but she certainly wasn't doing the job she was elected to do. If anyone in the private sector tried to go to work less than half the time, not only would they lose their job, but I have doubts where they would even collect unemployment. For having the worst record of any of our representatives, Representative Mombourquette doesn't even rate an F. She gets an I for damn incomplete. Being in the legislature is serious. And if you can't or won't go and do the people's work, you need to stand down and let someone else take your place. That Representative Mombourquette feels she deserves another term is ludicrous. I wouldn't vote for a member of my own party who thought it was appropriate to show up less than half the time. We shouldn't accept behavior like this from our elected officials. And for this reason alone, Representative Mombourquette is ill-suited to a second term in the New Hampshire House. The next factor I calculate is the party loyalty score. This compares how closely our representatives followed their party leadership and if they were able to break out of the party's shackles and vote on their own, or if they were simply mindless automatons that did whatever the party machine told them to do. This year's session was challenging to score because two of our representatives missed approximately half of the session. I suspect that were their full voting records available, their percentage of adherence to the party line would actually be higher. All the scores were over 90%. Representatives McGee and Mombourquette, despite missing slightly less or more than half of the votes, still managed to vote with the party machine 92.8% of the time and 94.8% of the time, respectively. Now I ask you, are those the voting patterns of people that are reading the legislation put before them and deciding for themselves, based on the needs of our community, what is best for us? Or are those the voting patterns of representatives that show up occasionally and push the button for whatever the party leadership tells them? I find such a high level of conformity to be at odds with the best traditions of the resourceful and rugged individualism that makes New Hampshire and the United States what it is. If any of these individuals, and I use the term loosely, in their campaigning claim to be considering the needs of our community, voters should take that claim with a grain of salt. Make no mistake, all of our current slate of representatives are good comrades and obediently follow their party leadership. Finally, we come to what our representatives voted on. First of all, let us consider the format of the 2020 session in which many omnibus bills were presented to the House. An omnibus bill is a bill containing many smaller bills lumped together in one big package. Usually, every bill in the New Hampshire House gets a hearing independently, but the Democratic House leadership decided that for this year, they would do away with such nasty technical requirements like those and cram 30 to 40 topics into a single bill and then limit public input. When we saw the Wuhan coronavirus balloon up in the early part of this year, I assumed that the New Hampshire House would scale things back dramatically, as public input would be limited by the pandemic, and the legislators themselves, many of whom are elderly, would be at risk. What was I thinking? It would appear that instead of doing the right thing and really having a limited session, instead, the Democratic leadership decided not to let a crisis go to waste and went with the omnibus bill format instead. Well, when you are in control, you are in control. The governor is a savvy political operator, though, and he signed some of these monstrosities, so maybe they were necessary. Beyond the format, let's consider some of the things that our representatives, in lockstep with their masters in the Democratic Party, thought were appropriate for us serfs, citizens, yes, citizens. The first thing I have to notice is that two of our reps bailed on all the dates in March, which was the month where the bulk of the work for the legislature was performed, so I can only assume that they would have had, in fact, voted with their party since they did so more than 90% of the time, the rest of the time. If you are going to do an analysis of people who don't have much, or really any, individual characteristics, it does tend to simplify my job somewhat. Let's start with the good news. Representative Woodbury and Representative Mombourquette both voted against their party leadership in regards to HB 1649, a bill that would have created a road usage fee which would have likely fallen on most vehicles on the road and would have been a massively regressive tax. So good for them. Next up, all our representatives, along with their party leadership, supported HB 1648, a bill that would have legalized possession of cannabis for adults, which is a little odd since some of our representatives voted against a similar bill last year. I don't know what changed in the last 9 months, but it's still progress and should be applauded. I was quite happy to see Representative Woodbury and McGee support a tabling motion on a bill that would have required helmets for people riding motorcycles. While it would have been nice to see the bill formally killed, nonetheless, a tabling motion is better than passage. In an almost unanimous decision, Representatives McGee and Woodbury helped shoot down a bill that would have placed a sales tax on electronics and ski lift tickets. HB 1492 and 1652 must have been real train wrecks of bills, because the House rejected them en masse. Representative Woodbury voted against HB 1608, the only one of our representatives to vote on this bill at all, a bill that would have prohibited the manufacture, sale, transfer, and possession of standard capacity firearms magazine. Representative Woodbury furthermore voted to kill HB 1115, a bill that would have affected our freedom to discharge a firearm in a compact part of a town or city. The bill must have been pretty unpopular, as it ended up with only 6 votes in support of it. But give credit where credit is due, and in this case, it is lauds to Representative Woodbury. And sadly, that is the end of the good news. All of our representatives, in conjunction with the Democratic leadership and the caucus as a whole, tried to choke the life out of towns that tuition their students to private schools. This bill would have effectively ended school choice in small towns like Croydon. If it wasn't for bills like this, maybe the public school system and their Democratic allies would not get compared to the Borg from Star Trek or the Blob of horror movie fame. They just can't help themselves. In an effort to find problems where none existed, the Democratic leadership and caucus decided to regulate music therapy. No doubt all of us will rest easier at night knowing that vicious gangs of music therapists have been confined to their proper sphere. And what might be arguably the worst bill of the session, the Democratic caucus, leadership, and all of our representatives supported a backdoor income tax in the guise of a family leave bill. No doubt our representatives would argue that extracting money from our paychecks isn't in some undefinable way an income tax, but I hope all of you will see through such nonsense-laden verbiage. If the state is taking money out of your paycheck, then it's an income tax. Probably the second worst bill of the session, HB 1218, a bill that would have allowed businesses and municipalities to build large-scale solar installations, up to 5 megawatts, and then sell the power back to the grid at retail rates without any of the controls associated with being a normal electric supplier. Now, a 5-megawatt installation is far beyond the capacities of a normal household installation. Even an excess capacity of 1 megawatt is probably beyond the means of most normal homeowners. On one hand, I am happy this bill died because the session ended, because otherwise it would have jacked up electrical rates for all resident and commercial ratepayers. On the other hand, I am sad this bill died, because I would have clear-cut my southern-facing hillside and put solar panels over every square inch of it. Needless to say, all our representatives supported this masterpiece of crony capitalism, or crony socialism, since it comes at us from the left. Of interest to firearm owners, or anyone who thinks they might someday need to purchase a firearm, is the attempt to impose a 3-day waiting period on purchasing a firearm. It's not like we live in a nation where there is a large deal of social unrest or riots, right? I can't think of any recent mass shootings that would have been prevented by a 3-day waiting period, but it might have resulted in fewer rapists or stalkers getting deservedly shot by their would-be victims. All of our reps supported HB 1101, clearly indicating which section of the population they find most in need of protection. Thankfully, HB 1101 was tabled in the Senate, but don't worry, it will probably be back next session. Also of interest to firearm owners was Bill HB 1379, a bill that would have required almost all firearm transfers to receive a proceed request from the NH gun line or the ATF before a transfer could take place. This means that unless the government said okay, it could halt all firearm transfers simply by not responding. When you consider that the ATF is currently besieged with requests for NCIS background checks and fails to respond to most requests, if this bill had passed, it would have choked the life out of gun transfers in New Hampshire. It gets better, though. If this bill had passed, it would have made transferring a firearm for the purposes of firearms training to become a misdemeanor. Do I need to say that all of our representatives supported this bill? Because they all voted for it. This is more or less the point in the session where two of our representatives simply stopped coming, so I am only going to briefly cite some of the other terrible ideas that the Democratic caucus tried to foist on the citizenry. While two of our reps may not have actually come to session, we can probably assume they would have voted for these dystopian train wrecks of legislation. HB 546, regulating art therapists, because who isn't afraid of unregulated art therapists, whatever art therapy is? HB 1472, regulating plastic straw distribution, which I know personally keeps me up at night. HB 1564, eliminating polystyrene phone in food containers. Truly a horror for us all. HB 1350, requiring a locking safety device be provided for commercial firearm sales because we don't have any bigger problems than law-abiding citizens getting fast access to firearms. HB 1459, which would have allowed public schools to inflict non-academic surveys on school children without parental consent. This seems reasonable, since our public schools have created nothing but geniuses for so long that it's fine to waste our children's school time with non-academic fire drills, like inquiring about sensitive topics at home. HB 1275, which would have allowed citizens to order laboratory tests without an order from a licensed practitioner. Wait, what? Why is that even illegal? If I want to check my blood sugar or cholesterol, I need a doctor's okay to do it? Thank God we were protected from being able to do this. preventing individuals from ordering their own medical tests has got to be a good candidate for the most paternalistic policy of the state. The citizens should be prevented at all costs from thinking that they own their own bodies. HB 1622, which would have required adults to wear seatbelts while traveling in motor vehicles. I think that wearing a seatbelt is generally a good idea, but I don't think it needs to be a law. There's more, a lot more. But I get bored about talking about the hubris, paternalism, arrogance, and sheer smug that the Democrats display so prominently when they are in control of the House. The spreadsheet is in the show notes for anyone that is interested. If anyone wonders why we aren't living in a socialist dystopia right now, you can chalk up a lot of credit to the short session, courtesy of the Wuhan coronavirus, and to the veto pen of Governor Chris Sununu. Sadly, my commercial life is going to take me away from my planned October surprise podcast. I'm sure everyone is very disappointed. Such are the times we live in, though. Perhaps next election cycle, we won't be dealing with the presidential election and a global pandemic at the same time, and I will have my podcast act in order a little sooner. But given the course of the last year, who knows what will come next? Well, that's the end of this journey. Thanks for letting me narrate our travels through these strange times. If you have comments or questions about the show, send your comments to me at strangetimesinnewboston@hushmail.com. Live free or die.